Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Adjustable firmness on each side helps keep you asleep and improves your sleep quality. My husband sleeps at a very firm 100, and lately I've been keeping my sleep number at 45. Neither of us has to couch sleep or go to the guest room if we need a different type of support. With just the click of a button, I have exactly the bed I need night after night. Discover the Sleep Number Smart Bed, the only bed that lets you adjust each side to your ideal firmness and comfort, your sleep number setting. Sleep better together, only at Sleep Number Store or sleepnumber.com. From your morning podcast to your afternoon playlist, we know you personalize your entire day. That's why State Farm helps you personalize your insurance with the State Farm Personal Price Plan. It offers coverage options that help protect what you care about most at an affordable price just for you. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices vary by state. Options selected by customer. Availability and eligibility may vary.
Hi, Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Ashley Flowers.
And I'm Britt.
And the story I have for you today is a real head-scratcher. One of those cases where a person just seems to vanish into thin air under almost impossible circumstances. This is the story of Stephen Clark. December 28th, 1992 is a nice enough day in Mask by the Sea that Doris Clark decides to head out for a walk on the beach. Her son Stephen makes the last minute plan to join. He was supposed to go to a football match with his dad, Charles, but like dad's trying to teach him a financial lesson at the moment and told him that if he wanted to go to the game, then he'd have to pay for himself. And even though 23-year-old Stephen has some money, like he's only an apprentice, which is basically like an intern here in the U.S. Like this is taking place over in the U.K., so he's like, yeah, no, you know what? A walk with mom's going to be just fine.
Walk with mom's free.
Free, yeah. And it's better than staying at home alone doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Doris and Stephen set out on this 2 miles path along the beach that takes them from Mass to this next door town of Saltburn. They walk this path often. The sea's on one side. There's cliffs above them on the other. So it's, I mean, honestly, picturesque. Now, once they get to Saltburn Pier, Stephen says that he needs to use the restroom. So he pops in real quick to the closest bathroom nearby, and Doris figures she might as well go to the ladies' room while they're there. She's not in there too long, and when she walks out, she expects to see Stephen waiting for her, but he isn't, so she waits on him instead. And she watches as other people kind of come and go. There are these two guys that show up with a little girl, and they take turns going in while the other waits with the girl. But they all end up leaving, and Stephen still hasn't come out. So now she's thinking, you know, maybe he just finished up before her, like, and didn't see her waiting and decided to just turn back and walk home.
Did she ask the men if Stephen was in there?
No, I don't think she talks to them at all. So, like, she again, like, at the time, she's not even, like, worried. They're just coming and going, and then she's just waiting. So, like I said, she decides to walk back home, see if she can find Stephen along the way or see if he's waiting for her at home.
But what about just going in and seeing if he's still in the bathroom?
So Doris actually addressed this question in a documentary about Stephen's case, and she said it would never cross her mind to go check on her 23-year-old son. And Stephen's sister, Victoria, says the same in a podcast episode for The Missing. Like, she is certain he would be straight up mortified if his mom walked into the men's room calling out his name.
I mean, to be fair, I would be mortified if my mom did that to me in general.
Right.
So totally fair.
And listen, even though Stephen does have limited mobility from a childhood accident, he is fiercely independent. So no, she's not going in and like calling his name like he's eight. She walks home. But Stephen's not anywhere along the path ahead of her. He's not there waiting for her at the house when she gets back. And now she kind of starts worrying. But she doesn't want to get ahead of herself. So she waits for Charles to get home from the match before conducting an all-out search. And you see, her and Charles were both part of the police force at one point. So presumably they'd be able to do that good search. Like, they know where to look. But when he does get back and she explains the situation to him, Charles immediately goes into not police mode, but just like dad mode. He goes back to the pier looking for Stephen, like calling out his name, but he does not find any sign of him.
And does he walk into the bathroom?
Well, nothing explicitly says that, but I mean, I gotta assume like that's the first thing he checked, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even though, I mean, him still being in the bathroom doesn't make much sense unless he collapsed in there. But I mean, I would check, so I assume he checked. When he gets back without Stephen, Doris and Charles call their daughter Victoria just to kind of let her know what's going on, you know, just in case her brother was to like reach out to her, I assume. But they tell her, listen, there's no reason to panic. Just in case, though, we're going to call the police and report Stephen missing.
I know they're saying not to panic, but I think I'd be full on panicking.
Oh, 100%. If I got a call from my parents saying that, like, hey, baby David is missing, we're going to call the police.
Don't worry, but we're calling the police.
Yeah, I'd be like fully on like, let's rally, let's search, like, let's go. And Victoria's no different. It's not clear exactly when, but she hops on a train back to Mask from where she's living in Guilford. And 6 hours later, she's home and ready to help search for Stephen. A search that they're gonna have to do solo. Because when Doris calls the police to report her son missing, the police make them wait a full day before taking the missing persons report since he's 23.
Ugh, tale as old as time, apparently even in the UK.
I guess so.
So do the police officially file the report once those 24 hours are up?
I think so, but there's no official documents I could find saying that a report was filed or exactly when a report was filed even. According to a documentary broadcast by ITV in 2021, and this is jumping ahead just a little bit, but apparently there aren't any records of Stephen's case from that time that still exist today. Nothing.
What do you mean? I mean, this isn't the 50s or the 60s when record keeping was like shoddy at best. This is the 90s. I mean, how do you not have any record?
I truly have no idea. That's just what I'm getting from the source material. And even if police actually do file a report, it doesn't look like they send anyone to search for Stephen when they do. So the Clarks are on their own. Now, they obviously start at the bathroom where he was last seen and kind of work their way out. But as the days go by, their search radius is just getting wider and wider, even out into the sand dunes and the cliffside surrounding the trail, just in case. I mean, it would have been much more difficult for Stephen to get around in those areas. But I mean, they're starting to wonder if maybe he fell somewhere or if he's stuck somewhere. I mean, is it possible he took the cliff lift nearby? It's at the pier and takes people up like 120 feet to the top. So maybe he went up there and there was some kind of accident like up there. But even that doesn't really make much sense because you would think someone would have seen him. And there's no way that his body could have just like washed out to sea or something because the cliffs don't even drop into the water like near the pier. It drops onto either a grassy section leading to the long sandy beach or to shops along the shore. So they're looking and looking. More days go by. And during this whole time, Victoria's mind is spinning. She's replaying the Christmas she literally just spent with her brother and wondering where the heck he could be. Now, she's 14 months younger than him, but the two are super close. And she's always felt really protective of him. She was actually interviewed for an episode of The Missing Podcast about Stephen, and in it, she talks about how growing up wasn't easy for her brother. That childhood accident he had left him with limited mobility in his left arm. He also had a distinctive limp when he walked and even some difficulty in school. But more than anything, it was really like the way people treated him that made her stick up for him when she could, which is partly why they're super close. She can't even begin to imagine a world where he's not there. So with each day that passes, she's hoping that someone will say that this is all just a big misunderstanding. Stephen's back, safe and sound. They'll all like look back on the situation and laugh. But that's not happening. And unfortunately, Victoria has to go back to work, go back to life, even though she wants to stay just in case her brother shows up. But even though she has to go back, she remains in constant contact with her parents. Now, while police still don't seem to be helping in the search at all, word is spreading throughout the community that Stephen's missing. Shortly after his disappearance, Doris and Charles start hearing about sightings of Stephen in the Saltburn Mask area, as well as this area called Redcar, which is just a town over. Basically, these three towns are all like in a line on the coast and Mask is in the middle.
Okay.
But what's significant is that these sightings aren't happening, or they're not like from the day that Stephen went missing. People are contacting them saying that they saw Stephen days after he disappeared.
Real quick, did anyone ever track down the two guys Doris saw near the restrooms that Stephen went missing from?
No, I mean, again, like she noticed them, but she didn't even take like detailed notes of their features or anything specific about them. Like, she wasn't expecting that day to turn out like it did, which I totally understand. Right. So they have not even the first clue how to track them down. Anyway, out of all of these sightings, two of them seem promising to the Clark family because they're from people who actually knew Stephen. So on January 3rd, this would have been almost a week after Stephen went missing, a family friend comes forward and says that he saw Stephen 2 days after he vanished, which would have been on December 30th, in Red Car. This friend says that he's pretty positive it was Stephen. He just didn't even know he was considered missing at the time, so he says he didn't actually approach him or anything.
What was he doing? Did he seem fine? Normal?
Yeah, I mean, it was like the quickest interaction, at least I think. The story, it varies a little bit depending on who tells it, but the gist of it is that Stephen just kind of walked past this family friend. This guy's wife later says that the husband actually stopped and talked to Stephen, but he never says that himself, so I'm not really sure. Again, he didn't know he was missing. It's kind of like Doris with the two guys. Like, it's you didn't know this was going to be important. But the significant part is that this man is positive that it was Stephen.
And Stephen was alone?
Mm-hmm, just him. So this sighting gives the Clarks hope that he's still out there somewhere. They don't know why he just walked away without a word. They don't know where he would be staying or what he would be doing. Honestly, they don't really care. They just want to find him and bring him home. And this is the first time in 6 days that they feel like they're within reach. And their hope is bolstered with the second sighting later that same month, one that might even offer a better clue as to where Stephen has been. David Huntley reports for Teesside Live that someone who knew Stephen through mutual friends saw him on January 14th, an entire 16 days after he disappeared. And this time, Stephen wasn't alone.
Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to take a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security. As the weather's gotten nicer, we've been spending a ton more time outside and at local parks. And I've noticed that our neighborhood has just gotten busier, buzzier, just more activity. So it's a huge sense of relief that as my corner of the world comes out of hibernation, my home and family continues to be covered by our fave, SimpliSafe. Our SimpliSafe home security system blankets our whole home in protection with a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over our property day and night, plus sensors that detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. For me, that more is a sneaky little six-year-old trying to play outside without a grown-up. SimpliSafe helps me say not so fast with entry sensors telling me when a door has been opened. And it's not just me. SimpliSafe is trusted by experts. They've been named Best Home Security System for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report, and Newsweek awarded it Best Customer Service in Home Security. SimpliSafe has given many listeners real peace of mind. You should have it too. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/crimejunkie. That's simplisafe.com/crimejunkie. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go for a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table, like countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams, or timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
This friend says she saw Stephen in Saltburn with a 50 to 60-year-old man who was of medium build, balding with gray hair around the sides, and wearing glasses. Now, when the family hears this, they have no idea who this man could be. Stephen wasn't friends with anyone who fit this description as far as they know. It doesn't really fit the bill for anyone his parents or sister knows either.
And it seems like Stephen was with him willingly?
Well, the woman who saw him claims that Stephen and the man weren't talking at all, and she couldn't tell if either person looked upset or not. They were just kind of walking together. Mm-hmm. But even kind of in a weird way, like the man was ahead of him and it looked like Stephen was trying to keep up.
Well, you know, with his limp and all, I feel like he would have had to have left with someone, right? Like, otherwise, his mom would have spotted him, and he's not likely walking to these other towns.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So I guess the question really is just, like, did he go willingly?
I mean, it's possible, but I will say that even if it was willingly, it didn't seem planned. Like, his wallet, his passport, everything was still at home, which you would obviously need those things if you had planned to run away or start a new life. And, like, again, this walk was, like, very last minute.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to, like, leave and start over, you would think that you'd go further than one town over.
Right. And do we know if he has any reason to want a fresh start?
No. I mean, not that Victoria knows about anyways. Like, when she last saw him during the Christmas holiday, everything appeared to be fine. That being said, though, he did ask her a pretty morbid question when she was there. Not about, like, starting over or running away or anything, but about ending things. He asked her, if she were to die by suicide, which method would she choose? And this is really dark. And without more context about when and how this is asked, like, I mean, it might send up some red flags for others. But whatever the situation was, it didn't really alarm Victoria at the time. She had kind of laughed it off, because they both had a, quote, like, dark sense of humor. She's only thinking of it now in hindsight, because, I mean, when nothing else makes sense, you kind of go back and catalog every interaction you last had with somebody who's now missing, looking for any clues into things they said or did. But even though she flags this conversation for her parents, for, I assume, police, like, she's still pretty sure that there's something else going on. Like, that's not what happened here. And she was super close with him. She believes that if something was going on, that he would have told her. According to a BBC article, the whole family was close and things felt wrong without Stephen. But also, things weren't easy for Stephen. And we know some people do suffer in silence. So despite having what seems like a really loving and supportive family, I mean, there had been some unsteadiness here and there. Like, his family had moved to South Africa when he was little, like a little after his accident. And while he loved growing up there, his accident left him with learning differences. And after he finished school, he was having a really hard time getting a job there, which is why the family had moved back to England. They had first gone to Guildford, where Victoria lives now, and then came to Mask, where the family was. And just like the move to South Africa had been an adjustment, moving back to the UK was an even bigger one. But, I mean, everyone was doing their best. Stephen joined an inclusive organization that helped him kind of acclimate to this completely different culture. He began making some friends. So to Victoria, he seemed to actually be starting to finally thrive there. But that did change in 1991 after Charles lost his job and the family had to move again. So this is when they moved to Mask. And it was that move that really shifted the family dynamic the most, because Victoria decided to stay behind in Guildford instead of moving with Stephen and his parents.
Mm.
And so even though he was, like, finally getting his footing, like, this time around, Stephen was again, like, having some trouble adjusting. So even though he was doing well in school and kind of in his social life, his grandma, who he was super close with, had just died, so he was presumably dealing with that grief on top of being away from his sister, who'd done all these moves with him, on top of being away from everything else he kind of was connected to.
Right, being in this new environment without without your sibling, which,
yeah,
based on their age, like, if they were close, like, that's...
Which they were.
That's your built-in best friend.
Yeah. And so, here's the thing. While all of that might feel like a lot, Stephen did have some good things going for him. So he had actually joined this new organization called the Rathbone Society, which was designed specifically to help people with learning disabilities find jobs and help them thrive independently. And through that, he was starting to find a place in the community. And he'd even recently won the Apprentice of the Year award at Rathbone, and things were starting to finally look up. He even seemed to have met a girl through Rathbone, not super long ago. I mean, this was like a week and a half or so before he went missing. And it was like not, I don't know, like, again, it actually kind of varies. So, like, what I heard is that, like, they would meet up at this local pub. His parents say it's not anything serious or long term. But then in later reporting, detectives suggest that it might have been a little more serious or getting serious, even though, like, his parents didn't realize, because they heard that he went and met her parents. But either way, even if they didn't think it was serious yet, it was just another sign to his family that he was putting down roots. He was getting settled there.
He was making connections, yeah. So has anyone talked to this woman to see if she knows where Stephen might be? Maybe has heard from him or something?
I don't actually know. So based on the way detectives talk about her in later years, it makes it seem like they might have, but no one ever says explicitly one way or another. And at the time, Doris and Charles are pretty adamant that they don't think she has anything to do with his disappearance. But also, it seems like there's no one else who had anything to do with his disappearance either. It's almost just this information void. And eventually, news about Stephen starts dwindling, leaving the Clarks to cope with this massive loss. Weeks start to pass, and then months, and eventually years go by with no signs of Stephen. His bank accounts, they're checking, insurance, I mean, nothing is being used. Throughout the early 2000s, there are some mentions of Stephen in the local papers, mostly about charitable efforts to bring attention to his case. Like, for instance, the Northern Echo reports in 2004 that an organization spotlighting missing persons features Stephen's case. There's another article in 2007 that talks about how a charity is trying to help, like, track him down. I mean, at that point, 15 years later. But there was one part that actually stood out to me. They include a message in their broadcast appealing to Stephen directly. They say, quote, "Stephen can also call our confidential service where he can leave a message reassuring his loved ones of his well-being that we can forward on his behalf. He does not have to say where he is."
So even after 15 years, there's still some assumption that he just up and left on his own.
Maybe not assumption. I mean, I think it's at that point hope. I mean, I think in our crime junkie brains, we automatically assume the worst. But while it's rare for someone to go off the grid and then just show back up decades later, it's not entirely unheard of. If that is what happened, though, Stephen never reaches out. The only other update comes a few years later when Doris and Charles speak out about needing a DNA database for missing people like they have for murder cases. And I'm not 100% sure what exactly they wanted, because I was able to find an annual report from the National DNA Database that says they've been collecting DNA to support the Missing Persons Bureau since 2010. So maybe they're talking about needing a completely different directory, like separate from the national one. I'm not 100% sure. They could also be trying to just draw some attention to Stephen's case. Now, after this article comes out, things go quiet again, and his family has to live their whole lives without Stephen there. Victoria, in particular, gets to the point where she has lived longer without Stephen than with him. She gets married. She has kids of her own. I'm sure in the years after he went missing, she thought of every scenario under the sun regarding what could have happened to her brother. Because again, when you have this information void, when you don't have answers, anything is possible. But then, out of nowhere, in September 2020, Victoria gets a knock on her door, and she is confronted with the one scenario that never crossed her mind. In the Missings episode, Victoria says that she opens the door and finds two officers standing in front of her. And they ask her, you know, "Is Charles and Doris Clark, are those your parents?" And when she nods, they tell her something that turns her world upside down. Her parents have been arrested on suspicion of murdering her brother. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/crimejunkie. That's rocketmoney.com/crimejunkie. rocketmoney.com/crimejunkie. Victoria's completely taken aback. Out of everything she'd thought might have happened, she never suspected that Stephen could have been murdered by their own parents. After a moment to, like, process it, she asks where her parents are. Her parents, who, according to that same missing podcast, are in their 80s now, by the way. And they tell her that they're being interviewed. And then they inquire if they can ask her a few questions because, you know, by the way, they never talked to her back when Stephen first went missing.
What? I mean, I know she was like a town over, but...
Yeah, zero investigation. So they're basically making up for lost time. Obviously, she agrees. And for the next like 4+ hours, they sit at her kitchen table just grilling her. They ask her about her and Stephen's home life and what it was like growing up in the Clark household, specifically if her parents were ever violent toward her or Stephen, to which she tells them, no, never. I mean, they were so close. Their move to a different country and then back only brought them closer and solidified their tight-knit family unit. But that doesn't seem to deter detectives, and they just keep pressing. But she is adamant. Her parents were never violent, never abusive. She doesn't think that they have any reason to have arrested them in the first place. And the more they speak, the more she can feel her faith in the justice system just crumbling. I mean, remember, both Doris and Charles were police officers. They raised their kids with the belief that if you were ever in trouble, go to the police. They know what to do. You'll be safe with them. So to hear officers in front of her accuse her parents of murder with seemingly no proof, like, her blood is boiling.
Okay, why is this happening at all? But why now? Like, how did we get here?
Wait, so here's the thing. So unbeknownst to any of the Clark family, the Cleveland and North Yorkshire Police Cold Case Unit had been actively investigating Stephen's disappearance since at least the year before they came knocking on Victoria's door. I don't know what made them reopen this case then, but as part of their investigation, they focused on an anonymous letter sent to police back in September 1999 that has some seriously concerning information regarding Stephen and his parents.
They had this letter for 20 years and they were just sitting on it? What have they been doing this whole time?
Nothing, I guess.
And the Clarks had no idea about this letter.
Well, here's the thing. So it depends on who you ask. According to the ITV documentary, Charles in that says that he vaguely remembers hearing about it, but claims that he never saw it. He says police never showed it to him or even really talked about it with him at the time. But reporting for Teesside Live says that police did talk to Doris and Charles about the letter. In fact, they say, quote, historic records show at the time the letter was assessed by officers and the information was recorded. These records also show that in November 1999, detectives visited Stephen's home address and had a conversation about the letter and its contents.
I'm sorry, it was recorded in historic records? What? Fucking records. You said there were no records.
I don't know what is going on with the records. Police say they don't have them, but then all of a sudden, like, again, they need to, like, back something up and then there are records. I don't know. So all in all, it seems like it's this letter that is the main reason Charles and Doris have been arrested. And Victoria's obviously got so many questions about it. I mean, first of all, what does it say? Who sent it? But the police won't let her read the letter. And they actually still have no idea who sent it. And what's really strange to me is that just based on how Victoria says they're talking to her, it doesn't seem like they would have had a motive. Like, that's not something that's presented. It seems as though police are almost trying to figure out what the motive would be from her. Or maybe they're just trying to get her to confirm what's in the letter without them telling her first. I don't know. It's all pretty strange. And I can imagine if this is how they approached Charles about the letter way back when, maybe that's part of the confusion. Like, the records show we talked to him about it the same way they talked to Victoria about it.
Right.
Right. So, like, but Charles wouldn't know what it said. And if it was about him, maybe he didn't even know the significance of it then. I don't know.
Well, I mean, surely they'll tell him what's in it now that they're grilling him, right? I mean, where are the lawyers? Someone get these people a lawyer.
Well, they don't get a lawyer this first go around. They are willing to cooperate and talk to police on their own. And later that night, they actually get bailed from police custody.
Okay, but what did they talk about?
So Doris explains in the documentary that they first split her and Charles up and interrogated them separately. And I mean, we know that's pretty normal mm-hmm. when there's more than one person like being looked at or whatever. But Victoria thinks that they did this to pit them against one another. Now, I can't find many of the questions that they were asked specifically, or even what investigators told them.
Which is all I want to know.
I know. Devil's in the details, right? But Doris does say that her interrogator was aggressive. He would ask her things. If Charles would ever, like, keep something from her to protect her. And she's like, I don't know. Maybe he might. But if the insinuation was that Charles was somehow responsible for the death of their son, like, I mean, she wasn't buying that. And then if what they're trying to do is get her to say something about Charles, then it gets kind of flipped, because by the end of the interview, all we know is that the officer interviewing Doris told her that she was violent, she's controlling, and she's a murderer. And they basically, like, tell her, just tell us where Stephen's body is.
Again, I'm at a total loss here. How is she violent? Why do they think she's a murderer? Like, this is all just coming so out of left field.
I know. Victoria has to be feeling the exact same way. Confused, lost, I mean, terrified for her parents.
Yeah.
But they don't get any real answers. Now, it doesn't seem like Charles told Victoria or anyone else any specifics of what was in his interview. But the outcome for both was the same. Detectives don't have anything concrete to keep them in custody, so it seems like they have nothing left to do besides putting all of their efforts into finding Stephen's remains, which the first place they do this at is the Clark's backyard. So they're doing this search of their yard, and they find what they call an area of significance. I'm not exactly sure what that means or how they find it. They didn't define it for us. But they jump on it. They start digging up the yard. They dig up almost every single inch of it, even emptying and moving a shed that they have in the back. But after all of that searching, they find nothing, though they're not done. They do, finally, what should have been done almost 30 years ago, and they start an all-out land search for Stephen in the area where he went missing. They're looking along the cliff sides, on the beach, in the sand dunes, all over. Now, as all of this is going on, public interest in Stephen's case has skyrocketed. Soon, the case gets a second wind, and the Clark family becomes a spectacle at the center of it. In the court of public opinion, Doris and Charles are already guilty, and they can't go anywhere or do anything without being hounded by reporters. And it leaves Victoria in this really difficult position, because on the one hand, she wants to publicly defend her parents and make her voice heard. But she also has her own family, specifically kids that she has to protect. And in the Missing podcast episode, she says that she's horrified that her kids aren't off limits, seemingly, to the media. Like, one reporter even reached out to Victoria's 13-year-old son.
Oh, hell no.
I know. So she, like, draws the line. She has to make the difficult decision to just stay out of the limelight while trying to support her parents, like, in the background. And at the same time, like, keeping an eye on this new investigation without putting her own family, like, in the public eye even more. And the fact that she's, like, not front and center makes the speculation just even more rampant, with reporters seemingly taking Victoria's silence as some sort of confirmation that she thinks her parents are guilty.
When all she's trying to do is protect her kids.
Yeah, and again, behind the scenes, totally not the case. She is fully team parents.
Right.
So, I mean, they're, like, I imagine, like, hunkered down. All they can do is wait and wait for some kind of news from the searches, hoping that if they find Stephen, maybe all of this will get cleared up. But days go by. No remains turn up. There's essentially no sign, at least that detectives share, of Stephen anywhere along this seafront. All along the way, detectives are continuously putting out appeals through this new investigation for anyone with information to come forward. Now, they don't outright say that they have reason to believe that at the time Stephen's potential girlfriend could have helpful information, but they do address her enough times in their conversations with the press that it seems like they want to hear from her about how Stephen was. Like, how was he acting? What was he doing leading up to his disappearance? But I don't know if they can't find her now, or if they're just covering all their bases. Like, I don't know why they're, like, saying this to the public as opposed to just going to her. It makes me think they can't find her.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, she never reaches out to them. But a new witness does. And the anonymous letter writer finally reveals themselves. There's a woman who comes forward saying that she saw Stephen on the day that he went missing. She says that she saw him later that same afternoon and he was walking away from the Saltburn Pier, which means that Stephen did come out of the bathroom and walked into town from the path that he and his mom were on.
And she's just kept this to herself for nearly 30 years?
pretty much. I mean, she said that she realized the significance of her sighting when she saw a report about Stephen being missing. Like, honestly, right, like when he first vanished, but she wasn't sure if what she saw was relevant or not. So she just didn't report it. She only came forward now because she thought, well, you know, like it's been all this time. Maybe the thing that I saw actually is helpful, which I don't totally like get the reasoning, but whatever. Like, okay, we're here now. They have this. And this kind of forces them to go back and look at those two other sightings of Stephen from way back in the day, the ones from like the people who said they like knew him or knew him through mutual friends. Mm-hmm. And this time around, they have some new insights on the credibility of those sightings. So that first sighting by the family friend that happened in December in Red Car ended up not being verifiably Stephen. I guess later on, the friend said that it was actually raining super heavy on the day that he thought he saw Stephen. He couldn't actually see the face of the person that he believed to be Stephen. He thought it was Stephen basically just because this person walked in a similar manner. So he assumed it was Stephen, which for what it's worth, he did have that limp. So he had a more distinctive walk than most, but certainly not the only one in the world who walked like that, I'm sure, right? Mm-hmm. And then police say that the person who reported the sighting that happened in January was actually too far away to confirm that the person they saw was actually Stephen. And it would have been dark at the time of the sighting, so detectives just don't think that that's super reputable either.
So we don't actually know if anyone saw Stephen after the day he went missing.
I mean, the truth of the matter is, like, this lady's coming forward all these years later, like, I don't know if we have a sighting of Stephen after his mom sees him go into the bathroom.
Right.
And are you ready for, like, everything else to fall apart, too? Ugh. So, like I teased, not long after all of the sightings fall apart, the mysterious letter writer comes forward. And again, you know, this letter was the whole catalyst for Doris and Charles' arrest. Well, it turned out to be written by a woman who had no direct contact with the Clarks and only wrote the letter because she had a feeling that this family she doesn't know murdered Stephen. Not because she had any substantial evidence or information that could actually back up this claim that would go on to destroy their lives.
So because this lady had a feeling, these parents of a missing person got arrested, got mm-hmm. interrogated by the police. Their yard mm-hmm. was dug up. Mm-hmm. Their lives were turned even more upside down than having a missing child.
Check, check, check.
Because she had a hunch?
Yeah. I'm sure it's, like, embarrassing when everyone, like, finds out.
It should
like,
be.
You can't undo the damage. Yeah. So in another Northern Echo report, investigators do eventually clear the Clarks as suspects. And that happens in February of 2021. I mean, this is all, like, unfolding, like, recently. And it was in that April that ITV releases that documentary, which was following Doris and Charles over the prior year during the investigation into Stephen's murder. And, I mean, that honestly, that documentary was a huge source for this episode. And in it, they maintain their innocence and they describe how that accusation impacted them. Now, if you go watch the documentary, I feel like I have to at least like address this because a lot of people talk about Charles and Doris's tone and demeanor. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube. If you go look it up, you'll see comments about how both parents seem, what people say they're like, oh, they're unconcerned with their son's disappearance. But I think like, again, if you go in, if someone's like going in already convinced of their guilt and looking for proof where there hasn't been any, it might look like evidence that they don't care about Stephen, like people are saying, but without literally any evidence of their guilt, I would like to remind everyone listening that you never know how you're going to react when something like that happens to you. I've watched it. I don't really see what other people see.
Well, and not just when something like this happens to you, but when you've lived with this for
right
almost 30 years as your reality, not knowing what happened to your child,
yes,
where your child is. And then on top of it, going through the hell that they just went through with the police investigation.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, the way that this, like, rips you open, to your point, you live with that for years. And then, after all those years, not only did police, like, not give a crap then and do nothing, but now you're paying the price because they didn't do a proper investigation and they're trying to arrest you and blame you for the son that you've lost and been grieving. Like, again, that's, like, the mentality I went in watching it. And people would have, like, definitely thought I was guilty because I would have been pissed. Like,
the fact that they're talking at all
yeah.
is a grace to them. They don't have to do this.
Yeah. And by the way, most people are just straight up uncomfortable in front of cameras. So, like, add that to the mix, too.
Totally. Just for another reference, does Victoria do the documentary as well?
No, but like I said, she later did that Missing podcast, and she says the only reason she didn't was, again, for the safety and privacy of her children, because they didn't go in after they were cleared. Like I said, they were filming that whole year where, like, the media was just coming after them.
Mm-hmm.
And she reinforces in the podcast that, like, she didn't step out of it because she thought her parents were somehow responsible for her brother's death. She fully believes them, and she still wants answers about her brother's disappearance. But the whole time, she's had to balance that desire for answers with being there for her family, which has had to take top priority. Now, after the documentary and the podcast episode comes out, media attention surrounding Stephen's disappearance, like, you know, there's that hot moment, and then it kind of just dwindles.
Mm-hmm.
The cold case unit is still working on his case, but since 2021, there hasn't been much of an update. That being said, investigators are very much interested in speaking to anyone who can provide insight into Stephen's disappearance. Maybe you were Stephen's alleged girlfriend, or you know who the girlfriend is. Maybe you're one of the two men with the little girl seen by the Saltburn Pier restrooms, like, or you know who these men are. So if you're listening to this and any of that applies to you, or you know anything, the Cleveland and North Yorkshire Police Cold Case Unit would love to talk to you. Again, Stephen disappeared on December 28th, 1992 at the Saltburn Pier. And before we go, Britt, can you share what Stephen looked like and what he was wearing when he disappeared?
Yeah, Stephen is a white male. At the time of his disappearance, he was 6'3" with a medium build. He has blue eyes, dark brown hair, and like you mentioned before, he walked with a limp and had limited use of his left arm. And today, Stephen would be 54 years old. He was wearing a navy blue parka and had on blue denim jeans and gray shoes on the day he disappeared.
So if you saw Stephen that day or remember any tiny detail, let detectives know. You never know what might crack this case. Missing People has a website set up where you can submit your tips. We'll link to that in our show notes. You can also call the Missing People's helpline at 116-000. That number's for the UK, so if you're in the US and you know something, again, go to the link in our show notes. And like that broadcast did so many years ago, Stephen, if you're out there and listening to this podcast, you can use the same tip lines to let your family know you're okay. I'll link out directly to the UK, like Cold Case Team, that stuff in the show notes as well. But before we close out this episode, it's important for you or anyone you know who is thinking about suicide to be aware that emotional support can be reached by calling Samaritans in the UK at 116-123. If you're in the US, you can call or text the Suicide Crisis Lifeline at 988 or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. We'll post even more resources in our show notes. You can find all the source material for this episode on our website, crimejunkiepodcast.com.
And you can follow us on Instagram at crimejunkiepodcast.
We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Crime Junkie is an Audio Chuck production. So, what do you think, Chuck? Do you approve?